From RTE Radio, I'm Niall O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
Well, hello, Mary. Tell me how the apocalypse is going in your prepper shelter. Yeah.
If you're in this occupation, this is the flat rate expense and we don't have to go to court about your wig.
So incredible to think we look up and see the Irish flag and we don't think of Daniel O'Connell, the man who truly inspired us.
Coming up on this almost Friday edition of Playback Daily, Oliver Callan's essential guide to the end of the world, how to avoid going to court over your hairpiece, and have we unfairly neglected the liberator himself, Daniel O'Connell? That's all on the way over the next hour of the Radio Catch-Up Show that's the second thing you put in your survival bag after the alcohol. And first up today, as part of his morning monologue, Oliver Callan was enjoying the springtime before things took a darker tone as reality intervened.
It's just lovely at the moment. You know, that's based only on walking around Dublin and mooching around, looking over walls into gardens and so on. And the smell of the hyacinths in particular. They're the ones, aren't they? They're making all the nice smells and shrubs budding and things spring to life. Cherry blossoms are out. Dry, lovely weather over here. Very little wind. Just hold on to it if you can, because we really, really need it at the moment, because the air is full of tariff talk and no confidence motions here. And people in the Dáil are quoting the lyrics to Wrecking Ball. The mood is a bit downbeat. And so it's no wonder then that the European Union is urging every household to stock a 3-day crisis survival kit. That's the thing to cheer you up of a Thursday morning. Get your crisis survival kit together and includes various things. National plan has been drawn up actually for real in many European countries, which are modelled on the Nordic models. They're always ready for a crisis in the Nordics, basically very downbeat people in their beautiful countries and their perfect cheekbones and skin and teeth. A survival manual has been sent to all French people this summer, the London Times reports. Belgium has a website with a printable list for household crisis packs. Basically all the Europeans are getting ready. It's a very European list as well, recommending that what you need to get through the first 72 hours of an apocalyptic style attack, cyber attack, war, insert, whatever disaster you're expecting at this stage. You need the water, of course, Wasser, non-perishable food, medicines, a battery-powered radio. Oh yes, we'd recommend that one indeed. A torch. Men love torches, particularly. Cash. Thought it's the end times. Board games, identity documents, a first aid kit, a Swiss Army knife, clothing and toiletries. Very good. None of that would work over here, of course. And that's why the team of this programme put together the Irish Survival Kit. How to get through the first 72 hours of the end times? Well, tea bags would be number one, absolutely central, even if you have to chew them on the last day of existence. The brand of your choice, of course. We wouldn't endorse one either way here, depending which part of the country you're in. Water, of course, needs to be up there. But the Irish version, that would be a hot water bottle. Yeah, need that, absolutely. The actual fluids, minerals. Water. Minerals have it all. Ideally, the flat 7-Up, which is well known for its medicinal properties. Don't ask the World Health Organization. Just take the Irish mammy for her word. And speaking of water, you're going to need the small Virgin Mary shaped bottle of holy water. Holy water, absolutely important. In fact, you need a lot of spiritual aids to get through these 72 hours, whether that's the Sacred Heart picture, which you can light up yourself to keep the little thing flickering, the Padre Pio relic that is now on its third generation of ownership, a lock of Daniel O'Donnell's hair, whatever you hold precious in the world, basically. Then, of course, you're going to need your Bible, whether that's the actual Bible. It could be the Farmer's Journal, so that you can keep the rural men occupied with a curse, the price of beef, even though it's through the roof. The Dunbelievables VHS tape, essential for those 72 hours. An Ireland's Own and your local newspaper of choice, Meath Chronicle, Donegal Democrat, so you can sneer at the bad photographs of whoever turned 40 to 80 that is pictured in the centrefold. Crisps, of course. Crisps are very important, followed by more crisps and crinkle cut crisps. That's very, very essential. 72 hours of survival. The tub of Suda cream. Don't check the best before date. That's only you don't mind that at all. No, it's not the proper one unless the label's nearly half worn off. Of course, the iodine tablets. We have to represent the government message here in RTC. Those iodine tablets, get them out the back of the bathroom cabinet since Joe Jacob sent them there in 2000 and something. And look into the messy drawer in the house. Go through sellotape, novelty sellotape, bit of gift wrap, some indeterminate batteries of whether they're flat or not, various receipts. Just take the whole messy drawer with you. Pull it out. Bring that with you. But don't forget the change of underwear. You know, your mammy, your auntie is always warned that if you're ever knocked down, if there's something ever happened, God forbid that they cut open your clothes and find that you're not in a clean pair of underwear. Oh my God. Even this emergency bunker, essential. You'll need two sets of biscuits now. Firstly, the normal informal biscuits, bourbons, Marietta, whatever. That's for you and the household. Then you need the good biscuits. These are the formal wear biscuits. In case someone you see calls around to the bunker in the Armageddon, they will be Kimberly, Mikado, things like that. You know, hello, Mary, tell me how the apocalypse is going in your prepper shelter. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And make sure you bring the half a Christmas cake that's been in the house since 1996. That doesn't go off. It does not go off. Don't mind what the young person in the house is saying about it. That's in the tin, in the shelf, the top shelf in the press, which is hard to reach to, beside all the greaseproof paper. Now, don't get it confused with the sewing kit that's also in the same quality street tin from the same era. Just bring the sewing kit with you as well. You're going to need that. And of course, after the 72 hours are up, you're going to need a sing-song. So you need a traditional musical instrument in the house. And failing that, a pair of spoons. That's what you're going to need.
Well, that escalated quickly. The Oliver Callan Apocalypse Survival Guide there. Indispensable, I think you'll agree. Make sure you keep this invaluable piece of audio handy wherever the end of the world takes you. Meanwhile, after going on for 5 minutes about the end of days, Oliver stressed that it's important to surface good news stories.
They have finally found one thing that Ireland is cheaper for in the world. Can you believe it? Now, sadly, it's not of any use to really anybody except for a handful of companies. It is cheaper to make television programmes in Ireland, according to the Americans. The American actor Rob Lowe has called out California's low film industry incentives, said it's cheaper to bring 100 people to Ireland. And this is an episode of a podcast that he did with the Adam Scott, who is the star of Severance at the moment and various things. So Rob Lowe was talking about his game show called The Floor, which is made in Dublin. And he said it's cheaper to bring them here. There are no tax credits in America and so on. And he's not even talking about the union, trade unions, he says. It's just the tax, the economics of it all. And basically saying Ireland is cheaper. And Scott is also talking about how dear it is to make things in LA, and wondered if the if various things would be made. Well, we'll let Rob Lowe describe what he's talking about here. Where is it? There?
Why do I shoot my game show, the American game show, The Floor in Ireland? It's like,
do you really?
I do. It's cheaper to bring 100 American people to Ireland than to walk across the lot at Fox.
Right.
Past the sound stages and do it there.
Crazy. There's nothing shoots in Los Angeles.
Nothing. Nothing.
Nothing. Just too expensive to shoot here.
There are no tax credits. So all those other places are offering 40%.
Yeah.
40%.
Oh, yeah.
And then on top of that, there's other stuff that they do. It's criminal what the California and LA have let happen. It's criminal.
Oh, geez, they're very welcome now to come here, that's for sure. Parks and Rec is the thing that Adam Scott was in, and he's saying if they were making that now, they'd be shooting it in Europe as well. It wouldn't be made in America because it's just too expensive. So that's wild. He also said, by the way, another hit show, Don't Forget the Lyrics, is returning to Limerick for filming next month in this podcast. And MovieExtras.ie is advertised for paid audience members earlier this year. A Bigger Stage is the company, the Irish company, that's made a lot of this happen. They're making all those shows for Fox in Ireland, in Limerick and in Dublin, and creating employment here. In some cases, they fly audiences. Sometimes they fly audiences in, and it's cheaper to do that than make it over there. Extraordinary.
Hey, could we get Adam Scott and his fellow Severance cast members to do an ORTBO in Ireland? Macro data refinement is second nature to the Irish. Anyway, let the good news continue. This time the good news is cancer related, which usually isn't good, but well, let's let Oliver bring the cheer.
Nearly 100% of people in Ireland survive at least 5 years after being diagnosed with non-melanoma skin cancer, which is the most common form of the disease. Melanoma is the more serious type of skin cancer, as we know. Survival rates have improved massively in the last few years. It's one of the good news stories, health outcomes in Ireland, one of the few. Survival rates up to 92% now. So 9 out of 10 patients survive at least 5 years, which is the 5 years being the marker for being clear of cancer. This is from the National Cancer Registry of Ireland. Good news, it says, for skin cancer patients in the country, because more than 11,000 people are diagnosed with skin cancer every year. It's the most common cancer in the country. And 9 in 10 cases are non-melanoma. That's the one, like basal cell carcinoma I was telling you about here last year as well. So that's good. Now, there is a little bit of bad news. The report warns the incidence rate for melanoma in women is continuing to rise. Which is worrying. Now, men are more likely to die from skin cancer than women. 1.6 times more likely, it says, and 2.3 times more likely to die from non-melanoma skin cancer.
That good news idea is going well, isn't it? That's just some of the roller coaster of emotion that was this morning's Oliver Callan monologue. The taxman taketh, but he sometimes also giveth, if you pestereth him. That's the odd, I know, way of introducing the Today with Claire Byrne item this morning with personal finance expert Owen McGee on how to claim back tax paid to revenue.
There are lots of things, are there, that people forget to claim back on?
Yeah, the first thing that people forget or don't do is they don't do a tax return at all. And that's a big problem because most people who will do a tax return, there is, depending on the research you look at, if you do a tax return and you're a PAYE worker, and then people go, oh, I'm a PAYE worker, I didn't think I could do a tax return. Yes. So if you're a self-employed, always do a tax return because they have to, and that's the way they operate. But PAYE workers who do a tax return, on average, depending on what piece of research you look at, we'll get a refund of between 800 and 1200 euros. Now, think about that for a minute.
That's a lot of money.
We're squeezed. That's potentially 100 quid a month. It pays for something for the next 12 months. Mm-hmm. Or it's a big chunk that clears off a credit card bill or does something else for you. So it is worth your while doing it. What I would say is some people don't do it because they're afraid and they're kind of going, oh, what happens if I owe the tax man money? What happens then? And one of the things I will say is, when it comes to this stuff, you owe the money already, you just don't know you owe it, right? And you're better off finding out for yourself than getting a surprise at some stage. So, and there's very few cases that I've seen where people do it and end up owing the tax man money. In general, it's the other way around. And as I say, on average, between 800 and 1200. So it is worth doing. It's also quite simple to do it now, particularly for a PAYE worker.
The tax return.
Yeah, like it's all online and it's very simple. It used to be a thing you'd be filling out in paperwork and it'd be loads of pages and half of them didn't even apply to you and you didn't know what to do with them. It's much simpler now because it's all online. And even down to things like the Tracker app, that's not an app, Tracker service, the receipt tracker service. You can load up your receipts as you go through the year onto revenues, onto my PAYE. And it just makes it so much easier to track the whole thing.
So load up your receipts. But what receipts are we talking about?
Okay, so the big ones would be medical expenses. So the perfect example, and that's all medical expenses, whether that's prescriptions or GP visits or physio or whatever else it is. Dental is a slightly different thing. You get covered for certain things and you don't get covered for other things. And there's a slightly different process. But when it comes to medical expenses, people often don't realise. And what people have got very good at is you go to your GP and it's 60 euros, let's say, right? I'm sorry if GPs are out there saying that's much more expensive or that's much cheaper than it actually is. I'm guessing it's 60 euros, right? 60 euros. People have got very good at doing their snap and send where they send it to their healthcare provider, like their Layer or VHI or whoever else they might be with, right?
And get their few bob back.
And they get their few bob, and that lands into their account a couple of days later. And let's say they get 20 euros back on the 60, right? Just as an example. The 40 euros that's left, you can get tax relief at 20% on that 40 euro. So in that case, in that example, you'd be getting 8 euros back in tax. So it costs you 32 euros to go to the to have the 60 euro visit. Mm-hmm. When you look at everything that in
and
that
if
example.
You have a family over the course of the year, that's probably going to add up.
Absolutely, you know? It is going to add up. So what I would say is one of the things about doing tax returns is it's much easier to do them little and often. And what I mean by that is don't come home and throw all the receipts into a drawer and say, oh, I'll deal with that. Because you'll always open the drawer and close it again and say, I'm not doing that. And particularly, you're coming into January and you're going, oh. So just try and do it as you go. Use those tracker, the receipt tracker service and upload the stuff as you're doing it. It's a much simpler way of doing it. And so you've got medical expenses is a big one. The other one is like prescriptions is another one. Most people will use the drug payment scheme where it's 80 euros that you have to pay yourself. But do use where you're paying for prescriptions. Dental treatment, as I said, is slightly different. But there are other things that we need to consider in terms of, one of the things I do want to say is people often get confused between the difference between an allowance and a credit. Okay, so an allowance comes off. So are you gonna an allowance against that? An allowance comes off your gross pay. A credit comes off the tax you pay. So the allowance comes off before you calculate the tax. The credit comes off the tax you pay. So let me give you an example. You've got 11,000 euros of income and you've got 1,000 euros of an allowance. That means you take the allowance off the 11,000. Now you're paying tax on the 10,000 euros. Whereas let's say you've got 10,000 euros of income. You work it out to Joe 4 grand in tax and you've got a 1,000 euro credit, that comes off the 4,000.
We're talking about claiming back tax that you have already paid.
Yes.
Isn't that roughly
that's exactly what you're talking about.
Okay, yeah. I have a text in here on prescriptions and medicines. Can all pharmacy receipts be claimed even for over-the-counter medications?
No,
it has to be
no.
prescription. So this person was getting a drug on prescription on the medical card, but that's been withdrawn, so I now have to pay for it. Well, if it's still on prescription and you're paying for it, yes.
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah. And it's interesting, one of the things that it can be on prescription. So, for example, if you have paracetamol, I don't think that's a brand, but if you've got paracetamol.
No, it's not a brand.
Yeah. So if you've got paracetamol on prescription, then it could be claimed. But if you just buy it over the counter, it's not.
You can't be claimed.
And I think that's reasonable because there's lots of things that we buy over the counter. But when a doctor says you need to take this, then revenue come along and say, OK, we'll support you on that one.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that makes sense.
OK, so even if you are in the drugs payment scheme, it's still worth doing that.
Absolutely,
is it?
Absolutely, totally. And you should be claiming all the expenses. It's 800 to 1200 quid up for grabs here.
Yeah, I think you're right on that. It's the same for the health insurance. People think, well, I'm getting something back from one place. I'm not entitled to get it back from revenue as well.
Yeah, but you are, because the bit that you got hit with, you're not entitled to get it back in that example we gave a minute ago on the 20 quid you got back from your healthcare provider.
But the rest of it?
The rest of it, of course you are.
Mm-hmm. What else have you got for us?
There's
then?
Some simple ones. The flat rate expenses is something that people often forget about. So where the flat rate expenses come from is, there was a great case a couple of years ago. When anyone who's ever done tax exams always hears about this case, where a barrister tried to claim the expense of their wig that they wore in court.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, no, you can't claim that as an expense. Now, you're not rocking up to the pub on a Friday night with your wig on, right?
You could only wear that for work.
Yes, you could only wear that for work. But
one of the
kind of things that happened, not necessarily as a result of that, but one of the things that has happened is there are groups of people, often represented by unions, have lobbied and have got flat rate expenses. So, for example, nurses is a great example. If you are supplied... And if they supply your uniform as a nurse and they clean it for you and you rock up to work every day and there's a clean uniform, you can still get 233 euros of an expense. If you have to supply and clean your own uniform as a nurse, there's a flat rate expense of 733 euros. So that is a really simple thing to do. You just put it through.
Decent, yeah.
It is. Interestingly now, Claire, as a journalist, you could get 381 euros as a flat rate expense.
Really?
Yeah.
Did not know that.
And they are. And there's a whole list of them. There's lots of different things. But basically, it just has simplified the whole process for revenue. If you're in this occupation, this is the flat rate expense and we don't have to go to court about your wig type of thing.
You can have my wig when you prize it from my cold, dead head. Personal finance expert Owen McGee there, talking all things claimable from revenue on this morning's Today with Claire Byrne. The 250th anniversary of the birth of Daniel O'Connell, that's the Liberator now, not wee Daniel the crooner, will soon be upon us, and some are suggesting that Kerry Airport should be renamed in his honour. One of those who's in favour of the idea is John Crotty, who spoke to Katie Hannan on this afternoon's Liveline.
I think Daniel O'Connell is the most substantial Irishman of all time, and he's been overlooked for far too long.
And actually, it was only when I was looking at this today, I was thinking, it's amazing that there isn't more statues, buildings, you know, things named after Daniel O'Connell, because he is such a huge figure in our history.
He is massively. And, you know, there's a very obvious reason for that, Katie. It's simply because he wasn't a Republican. And Ireland, of course, went down that Republican route in a very big way, certainly from the late 19th century. But once the Easter Rising happened, you had this obsession almost with the Republicans, with the men of Easter week. And of course, they deserve their place, but it shouldn't have been a case of dismissing Daniel's input almost because of his moral force needs.
OK, take me back. Tell us a bit more about him then, because I know you're a bit of an expert. Go back. So born, as we say, 1775. When did he sort of come to public prominence?
You know, he was a solicitor by trade and a famous one. You know, he was exceptionally good in his trials. He was often quoted in the newspapers. He had a way with words his whole life. And that was being picked up from a very early age as soon as he entered the profession. But, of course, when he turned his attention to national affairs, and first it was Catholic emancipation that he really became the celebrity figure, when he formed the Catholic Association, you know, the uptake on this was just enormous. You had hundreds of thousands, even millions of people suddenly engaged in political activity. This was just unheard of at the time. You know, if you wanted to do something back then, you had a revolution, not this kind of public upswell of people, I guess, agitating politically. It was practically unheard of, and that really is where his legacy comes from.
Yeah, because of course, as you say, this was a time before, you know, when communication wasn't what it is now. There was no mobile phones or no social media groups to you know, gather people and get people you know, involved in campaigns. But he used to have these giant rallies.
Yes, these monster meetings are the stuff of legend. You know, they're upwards of between 500,000 and quite possibly even at the largest, 1 million people. You know, and you have
can we believe that though? Because I know that's the reports and that's what we. But do these things grow? Literally grow in size in terms of the telling.
Undoubtedly, yes, undoubtedly there's exaggeration there. But even allowing for fairly gross exaggeration, you know, they represent an enormous achievement. You know, most of these people are living subsistence existence, living day to day, hand to hand. So to motivate them to that extent, that they're willing to travel for days, as you said, no cars, no planes. Many of these people are hiking for nights and nights on end to get to these events.
He was, I suppose, he was a kind of a he was a celebrity politician in his time, right? He was, I tell you, it always strikes me as well. It was something that I remember being told as a school child about him, and maybe it might be another reason why he kind of fell out of favour or wasn't in vogue with in the era of Dev and that more kind of ascetic attitude towards morality, that it was always said that you couldn't throw a stone without hitting one of Daniel O'Connell's children.
Yes, this is true. Like so many great figures in history, there are many great traits, but there are the inevitable flaws as well. And certainly that's there. It exists. He was certainly, you know, bombastic. He could be aloof. He could be needlessly insulting with some of the people he dealt with. But I think on the whole, certainly from the research I've done, you have an individual that we can laud while recognising perhaps those inevitable flaws.
He inspired, you know, movements and he was inspired himself by the French Revolution. Is that?
Yes, certainly, in part. I mean, he took no part in the first French Revolution. He would have been a young man in his early 20s. Going right back now to 1798. Mm-hmm. He was not involved in any of these violent conflicts when they arose. But certainly he would have been a product of that generation. You know, The Rights of Man would have been published in the late 1700s. And it's influencing people on these ideas of liberty, equality. You know, he was a passionate spokesperson for it, but ahead of his time with the moral force means, with the idea of agitating for this peacefully.
And people speak of him in the same breath as like the real greats of that, of world history, like Gandhi and Martin Luther King.
Yeah, and no question he had an influence on these people. You know, he very much laid a template and the groundwork for these kind of individuals to say that with a large body of people, you can achieve significant overtures and overturns. You know, it's such a tragedy in the end that he couldn't deliver repeal of the Union and get the Parliament back in Dublin, because I think he'd be much more established as he deserves to be today.
And is it true as well that he had played a role in the tricolour? Because I know there was a lot of debate around the flag that would represent the Irish.
Indeed, absolutely, yeah. You know, I mean, that credit wrongly goes to Thomas Francis Maher.
Yeah.
It was very much Daniel O'Connell who was voicing this. I mean, as early in his career as 1810, he was calling for the people of Ireland to work together, the Catholics and Protestants to unite. And after Catholic Emancipation, when he moved on to repeal of the Union, it was his principal way of trying to get the Irish people to deliver their own independence. And he called for green and orange to unite, and it actually happened in the early 1830s that we saw the first tricolours. So very much as a result of Daniel O'Connell's involvement. So incredible to think we look up and see the Irish flag and we don't think of Daniel O'Connell, the man who truly inspired us.
Yeah, you don't. I was surprised to see that being referred to. Where he's buried in Glasnevin, John, is he?
He is. And I think if you've ever been there, you know, there's a round tower over his tomb. There's an enormous tomb there. And I think it shows the level of infamy he achieved in his own lifetime, that you have those kind of, I suppose, honours. We just haven't continued those honours in later generations.
That's John Crotty making the case to Katie Annan on this afternoon's Liveline for Daniel O'Connell to be honoured in his native Kerry as we approach his 250th birthday.
I'm in Turkey at the moment. I got here at the last Saturday from Lebanon.
That's Kerry man Tomás Mocatir, who has been cycling around and near war zones for a long time. Why is he doing this? Oliver Callan asked him to give us his motivation.
I came to Turkey just for a bit of a break after a quite intense period between Lebanon, Syria, etc. And there's been some protests kicking off here against the government, so it's not really been much of a break at the moment. But
extraordinary. You travelled from very kind of dangerous zones and into Turkey, where you would assume it's safe, and it is safe to travel to Turkey generally, and now there are protests. When did you start off, or where have you been?
Yeah, so it's been kind of all over the place. I started in 2016, and it wasn't meant to turn into a world cycle at all. I'd finished my undergrad course in NUIG and then decided to go and do a bike ride across America just to see what it was like, test the waters. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And I came back home after that trip. And yeah, just tried to go back to uni to do a master's course. Didn't work out. And then I said, bloody hell, I'll go again. So I decided to go to Africa, thinking like if I do one big one, then I'd like to do Africa, you know, just go jump into the deep end straight away and see what it was like. And yeah, I rode Africa for 7 months from Egypt all the way down to South Africa. And it was just an incredible eye-opening experience, you know, especially traveling through countries that were told not to really travel to. And I just saw a completely different side to the world and a different narrative to what we normally get told. And I was like, right, well, I want to see more of the world now. So I booked a one-way ticket to New Zealand to cycle home. And that's the one I'm still doing now. But obviously, COVID happened and I got delayed. And
you come back to Ireland.
Yeah, I've had to stop to work and save up. And it's nice to take a break because it does get, you know, it might sound ridiculous to people, especially once you don't travel long term like I do sometimes, but you kind of just get like travel fatigue, and you start noticing like that your interactions with people aren't the same, or you're kind of losing motivation, and you know, you're kind of forcing yourself onto the bike every day because it's obviously a huge physical toll on yourself, but also mentally and emotionally. And that's why after like the last stretch through Syria, Lebanon, I was just like, I need a break. I just need to switch my head off for a bit and just like book into like a hostel beside the sea and just chill out for a bit.
Generally, it's just you and your bicycle, basically.
Yeah. And you're constantly on the move, like day to day. You know, your biggest worries are just obviously keeping safe, finding, you know, making sure that you're eating well, getting enough water into yourself. And then, you know, by evening time, you're looking for a place to sleep. So you don't really know day to day where you're going to be sleeping unless you're in like a city and you pre-book a hostel or something. But most days, you know, you just cycle till sunset, try find a safe place to camp out of sight, you know, and then get going again the following day. So it's quite exciting like that as well.
You're a restless Kerry man by the sounds of it. And where's home when you do come home for the pause and to reset? What do you do when you come home? Who's at home?
My family, we have like a bar down in Kerry, in Ballyfarter. It's about 8 miles west of Dingletown. So it's busy in the summer. I just can't do Ireland in the winter anymore. I vowed to myself a long time ago I'd probably never stay home for a full winter ever again. It's a good time to get away. And especially just while I'm still in this like travel mode and while I just want to get it all out of my system. But yeah, it's nice to go home for the summer. You know, there's a bit of buzz around, there's a bit of crack. There's obviously plenty of tourists down in Kerry. So you're kept busy all the time. And then, yeah, it's good just to go back and help my dad out with the bar. You know, there's food, there's the bed and breakfast. So there's enough to keep you busy for the whole summer.
And have you somebody there? Have you a gra behind?
I do. Yeah, I do. A Ukrainian girl. She's lovely.
Really?
So it's tough being separated like this, but you know, thankfully, she supports me and she understands that, you know, this is a trip I've been on for a long time and I'll probably be restless until the day I finish it. So, yeah.
She loves the sight of Ondangan down beside her. You're out of Kerry. Did she come in, by the way, before or after the war?
Just after it.
So she came as one of the refugees, essentially, coming out of Ukraine.
Exactly, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And she loves it down. Like, she's pretty much a local now. You know, everyone is mad about her. Everyone loves her. And she's working away and she's happy out there. So
and
it's
so
great.
Meanwhile, on this stint that you're doing, you alone and your bicycle, you hadn't planned on going to Syria. How do you accidentally end up going to Syria?
Yeah. I know, it sounds a bit mad. So I went back in October and I was pedaling around, like, you know, UAE, Oman, Saudi Arabia. And when news filtered through about the revolution in December, like late November, early December, of course, I was keeping a close eye on it. And then, yeah, after Saudi, I was heading towards Jordan. So, you know, I was in the direction of Syria. I wasn't going to Syria. My plan after Jordan was going to Iraq, back to Iran, Armenia, Georgia, and then loop back into Turkey from the north. But once I was in Jordan, you know, Syria just became so, so, so appealing. And I started to dig into it a bit more, but I couldn't find anyone who has cycled there in the last 15 years.
Wow.
So I pretty much...
For obvious reasons, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, with the civil war and stuff. But I'd seen some other travelers start going back, but only to like Damascus and a couple of the cities. Towards the end of my time in Jordan, I was like, look, I have to make a decision. Like, and I was just like, it comes down to the simple question of like, why not? You know, when am I ever going to get a chance to go to Syria again? Who knows what's going to happen? It's still obviously extremely volatile there. So I didn't know, like, maybe if I come back in 6 months, it might be better, but it could be worse. So I said, I just rock up to the border with my bike and see, like, if they let me across. I was just like, I don't know if they were going to let me across the border at all.
And the border from where?
With a bicycle. From Jordan, so north of Amman.
So what happens at the border?
I got in.
They just let you in?
Yeah. No questions asked. Just stamped the passport and I just wheeled off. And from the get-go, it was as if you'd just been transported into a completely different universe. You know, you cross from Jordan, which is peaceful and stable at the moment. Then you get into Syria. First thing you see, just everything's destroyed. Buildings, like, they either have bullet holes or they're partially destroyed or fully destroyed. But the people are really, really friendly there. And of course, being on a bicycle, you know, you people looking at you, staring at you, but no one was being over intrusive or anything like that. They were just wondering where I came from. And on my very first day, after like a couple of hours of cycling, I headed towards a town of called Darar, which had only been bombed by Israel like the previous day. Mm-hmm. But a local guy stopped me, you know, invited me to stay with him, got to spend the evening with locals, because there's no, outside of like Damascus, there's not like, and some of the other bigger cities, there's no real accommodation. So you kind of have to depend on local people.
Not sure we actually got to the why there, but maybe it's just wanderlust. The very curious cyclist Tomás Mocketeer, talking to Oliver Callan this morning about his travels recently in war zones around the world. SMRs, sedentary meerkat retainers, are becoming increasingly... Wait, sorry, I'll read that again. SMRs, or small modular reactors, are being promoted as the future of nuclear power and a possible part of the solution to Ireland's clean energy problems. This morning, Claire Byrne discussed this with Lynn Boylan, Sinn Féin MEP for Dublin, and James O'Connor, Fianna Fáil TD for Cork East.
There's a couple of angles, but one of the ones that sticks out to me, unfortunately, is our national security in Ireland. And this has been a very rude awakening for us since the conflict in Ukraine broke out. And now we're seeing this hybrid terrorist activity, state-sponsored activity in relation to cutting of cables, you know, in relation to what's happened with gas infrastructure in the Baltics region. And we also have seen by recent news reports that our own Air Corps are monitoring activity by Russian-registered vessels off the coast of Ireland in relation to sensitive areas where there is this grid infrastructure. So I'm coming at this from the point of view that Ireland is importing a significant amount of our fossil fuels that we require to receive from different parts of the world. But we also have a renewable industry in the area of wind that is very, very promising. But I suppose, being realistic about it, we need to have a system that's secure, that there is a significant amount of power that can be generated to support our foreign direct investment based economy here, and the growth in data centres, the growth in multinationals and the pharmaceutical sector we were discussing earlier, and how Ireland remains competitive. Because one area, Claire, we have a serious problem with is that we are significantly more expensive than some of our EU colleagues that have nuclear in power production.
On energy security, though, if you're going to start looking at nuclear, does the nuclear plant, or whatever it might look like, not become a target then? Like we have seen in Ukraine with the Zaporizhia plant, for example.
It is a genuinely good question and something I've thought about doing my research for this. But I suppose the reality is that any piece of critical infrastructure, airports, I could list many, are targets. And in relation to that, there needs to be seriously appropriate pieces of policy. I suppose putting in place security policy around that needs to be done. And this has been done very successfully by other European colleagues. So I think the comparable for Ireland, of course, is Finland, same population as us. And they've gone now, they've just opened their fifth nuclear power facility and are almost generating up to 35 to 40% of their power production in Finland through nuclear power. And it's carbon neutral. It's a very, very good solution. That technology has rapidly advanced since the days of Chernobyl and Three Mile Island.
That example in Finland, I was reading about that, the initial cost estimated was 3 billion. It was triple that in the end.
Exactly.
We're not great here at keeping a lid on costs. Now, I don't know what the Finnish are like, but if we were to follow that example, it would put the children's hospital into the halfpenny place.
You're right. And cost inflation in this is a factor. And why I'm raising this, I suppose, is why I feel it is worthy of conversation and debate. It's not that I'm pushing exactly the full need to do this immediately, but it's worth that conversation is because it is a security aspect in my mind in relation to Ireland actually having the capacity to support our energy grid, you know, upgrading the necessary infrastructure that we need to do because we've grown from an economy of 4.5 million in the noughties to now in 2025.
Right. So you think we should be having the conversation? Let's hear what Lynn Boylan thinks. So is it worth having a conversation around these small nuclear reactors for the reasons that James outlines?
Well, I mean, James is using the argument of energy security. The small modular reactors don't exist. There is none in the world that's operational, no SMR. And in fact, if you look at the cost element, which you're right to raise around Finland, nuclear power in as a whole is really, really expensive. Ireland already has some of the most expensive electricity in the world. The small modular reactors that James is referring to that could be possible for Ireland, if you look at America, they tendered in 2012 to commission two small modular reactors. In 2017, one went bust and the second one still isn't operational and it's already cost 4 billion euros and not a single bit of electricity has been generated from it. In relation to the cyber attacks and security, again, you'd have to be reliant on where the uranium is. So you have to import the fuel for nuclear power. Ireland is uniquely positioned in our offshore renewables, in our solar, in our battery storage. The message we should be sending out is that that's the direction of travel that we're investing in. We would have then be using our own resources. So we're far more energy secure to focus on renewable. But renewables are also faster, they're cleaner and they're much, much cheaper. So we would also be bringing down the price of electricity for households. Nuclear is just really, really prohibitively expensive and the countries that continue to use it heavily subsidise it.
Okay, so a lot of problems there, James, outlined by Lynn. It's expensive. The small modular reactors don't exist anywhere. There's another big problem with this, though. I mean, you open up a debate that's going to get very fractious. It's probably going to take years to get anywhere. We already have the solutions in place, don't we, to decarbonize. Why not just pursue them, like solar, like wind energy, and stop going down the rabbit hole of something that might never come to fruition?
Keeping pace with our growth has been a very big part of what the work of government is doing in relation to Ireland 2040, you know, the National Development Plan, which will be looked at in the lifetime of the current government and reviewed. But in reality, I've seen this in Cork. My own constituency is actually going through a huge transition where massive amounts of agricultural land are being turned into solar farms. Some in excess, the applications are up to 1,000 acres, over 600 acres in terms of what's being, discussed. So I'm seeing massive amounts of our green fields, of our best agricultural land in the country, in the heart of the Golden Vale area, right down to Middleton, the home of whiskey distilling in terms of the agri-food industry in Ireland, being transitioned for solar.
And you don't want to see that?
It's an important part of the decarbonisation process, but, you know, it's generated enormous public unhappiness in my own area and other constituencies in rural areas, particularly that take the burden. I know if you're in the leafy suburbs of South Dublin or in our urban areas, that this is something you see on a daily basis. But for us that are in rural constituencies, we do. And well, onshore wind as well.
Those constituencies prefer to see nuclear.
Well, the reality is that the actual land space that's required for doing that is absolutely fractional in comparison to what's going on at the moment in places like Cork. And look, it's part of a multi-strong strategy. There are days the wind is not a, is not blow enough to generate enough electricity. There are days in Ireland we've actually had our entire country's grid powered because it's been sufficiently windy. In the same, when it's a night, just a second, in at night, of course, we have the issue that solar doesn't work. So you do need to have a system in place if you want an entirely decarbonised grid that's going to power an economy with electrified rail, which the state is currently undertaking, decarbonising our industries and heavy industries and other things in Ireland that, that will require significant more power.
Just let's look back at nuclear
as an option in that discussion.
Yeah, go ahead.
There's two elements to deal with. One, I might live in Dublin, as James says. They're not going to be putting a nuclear power plant in Dublin either. They're going to be putting it in a remote area away from densely populated areas, which is James's constituency. But you also have to deal with the waste issue. So a 2022 study in Stanford and British Columbia showed that these small nuclear reactors, if they ever exist, will produce between 2 and 30 times more wastage just by the nature of the way that they operate.
That doesn't sound good, does it? Lynn Boylan, Sinn Féin MEP for Dublin, and James O'Connor, Fianna Fáil TD for Cork East, debating the potential, as yet unrealised anywhere it seems, of small modular nuclear reactors to solve Ireland's energy problems on Today with Clare Byrne this morning. On this afternoon's Ray D'Arcy Show, intrepid reporter Sinead Ní Uachán was on a mission in North County Dublin, but on her way to her ultimate destination, she took the time to stop off and talk to people in the area about their favourite sounds in nature.
I wanted to find out what sound it is in nature that is your favourite. The listener, the person on the street, and I went as far as, I was in around Dublin, and I met Shona first and asked her the question.
Probably the ocean or like the waves. It's like calming. It sounds like summer and like being on the beach all day.
See what I did there. Go on.
Beach all day. Very nice. Danae was next.
I think my favorite sound is when the wind is really strong and it starts moving the trees and you can hear the leaves falling and all that. Like when you're walking, that's my favorite sound, yeah. It reminds me of home. Like I grew up in a farm, so it just reminds me of home. It brings me like serenity. Like certain smells just bring me back to my childhood and sounds. I think senses are really important when you try to remember things.
And where's Danae from, Sinead?
Danae is from Chile.
Ah, right.
Yes. She has a nice accent, doesn't she? But what she said there, sounds bring back memories. That's so true. Listen to Emma as well.
I love the sound of like birds like rustling around the trees, so like just hearing them chirping and everything.
What does it remind you of?
Reminds me of like kids playing, like hearing the sounds of them playing out in the streets, stuff like that.
Can you identify the birds?
Not really. I know a crow and a seagull maybe, but that's about it.
That was Emma.
Yeah. I think I'd know a crow and a seagull as well, but I don't think I'd know the call of other birds. Definitely not. Oh, I don't know the call of those birds I can hear in the background there anyway. Next up, Devereaux.
I really like when it's like heavy wind, but when you're indoors, it's better because it makes you feel like mad cozy and all. Do you get me? It's just comforting, like I'm indoors, but like the noise is still there. Do you know what I mean?
What's your favorite pastime when it's windy outside? Is it like watch a nice movie?
Yeah, kick back, get like a nice hot cup of coffee, watch a movie, get in comfy clothes, just relax. Do you know what I mean?
There you go. He has it sorted, Devereaux, doesn't he?
Oh, sounds so cosy, doesn't it? When you're all nice and warm and wrapped up inside. Marcus is next.
Probably be a waterfall. Why? Because I'm not sure why. It just sounds nice, you know? I could fall asleep to it. Dogs barking, actually. That's a nice one because, you know, it's just relaxing to me, personally. Some people find it annoying.
Do you have a dog yourself?
Nah. I have a cat, though. I have a cat.
You're not a fan of that noise?
No, I'm not.
Sorry to Marcus and everybody else, we couldn't get an audio clip of a dog barking beside a waterfall for him.
You never know, somebody might be listening down in Power Squirt and send an audio piece on. Be good to have.
Wouldn't that be brilliant?
Save it to the database.
Have a show of collecting audio. I'd love to do that someday. We must do that. That's a great idea. Thanks for that. Now, who was next?
Rory.
I like the sounds of the birds chirping in the morning. When you're ready to college, if you have to get up at like 9 a.m. or something, like, it spurs you on to get to college. Have a nice aesthetic coffee in the morning and all. So
some of the alarms that they have on phones almost sound like birds. Yeah. Would you be a fan of that?
I personally just have the default alarm on my phone. Plus, I feel like the birds are kind of peaceful. It would put me back to sleep if I was to hear them.
What's your favourite bird?
I like pigeons because they're overhated and underrated. I think people think they're dirty, but they're actually quite like chill.
They do get a hard time though.
They do. I think justice for pigeons, I think, is the message here. I think we need to like support them more and like look after them better.
The campaign starts today.
It does start today, yeah. I am going to be the captain of the campaign.
Rory, the captain of the pigeon campaign. He's a way of words, over-hated and underrated. Will you tell me this now? What's an aesthetic coffee?
An aesthetic coffee, is it like having the coffee in your hand? It might be one of those cold coffees with lots of ice and milk on top and sometimes flavours through it so that it's coloured. But I suppose it's about the idea of having a coffee in your hand and what that represents. Maybe okay. It would be my understanding of it. You're busy, busy, busy. Oh, sure, I can't start the day without my coffee. It's
an aesthetic. Right. Well, look, if anybody
that's
knows.
That's my understanding.
If anybody has any more light to shed on an aesthetic coffee, please do. 51551. Sarwat was next.
A lot of favourite sounds, but I would say, you know, the chirping of birds, the flowing of water. I would even say sometimes even when you are peaceful and when you are sitting, you can even hear the breeze. Oh, my God.
Do we give ourselves time enough to pause?
I had not done it. I am doing it now and I am loving it. The benefit is that, you know, that you feel yourself, you relax.
Yeah.
We have to do more of it.
Listen, stop and listen. Take the old headphones out off and have a listen to what's going on around you.
Because I'm a divil when I go for a walk. I have to have my headphones and connected to Spotify or iTunes or something. And so you're not aware of your surroundings when you're listening to something else.
I came across
bicycles.
This new phenomenon. So it's up there with aesthetic coffee. It's called raw dog. It's raw dog. It's where you go for a run or a walk without headphones. Wow, that's wild. Huh? That's a thing.
I'm going to give it a go.
They've given it a name.
Dog.
They've given it a name.
That's just going for a run, no?
Yes. I raw dogged it. Oh, yeah. Well done, you.
Oh.
Okay. Right, come on.
Next up, Mohammed Yaqub.
The sounds of seawater. A long time ago, when I was a kid, I read some novels and the beach was mentioned. So that reminds me of those novels. I enjoy the nature and when we listen to or hear these natural music or natural sounds, it gave us comfort.
Thanks, Mohammed.
Nicely put. Mm. Ben is next.
Probably the rain, like when you're inside. It's just nice. Like it's calming when you're inside, but when you're outside, it's just a mess. But,
Some people listen to it to fall asleep, the sound of rainfall. Is it relaxing in that way?
Kind of, yeah. Like it kind of puts your mind off things. If you wake up in the morning and it's raining and you're able to sleep in, that's a great feeling.
Yeah. That's nice.
That is a great feeling when you know that you don't have to be anywhere by a certain time and it's raining outside and you're nice and cosy inside. It reminds me of a spa as well, of course, those sounds that you hear when you're getting a massage.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Rainforest.
Yeah. Massages. That's another day's story. Okay. Finally,
Tommy.
One time I was in Donegal and it was night time and I could hear a wheel crying away in the distance, and to me that was the most beautiful sound I ever heard.
Can you remember what it sounded like? Can you do an impression?
I couldn't even make an attempt of it, to be honest with you, I couldn't. It was just lovely hearing that high pitch and then a click sound and a high pitch and a click sound. I don't even know what kind of wheel it was. From it coming out from sea, coming towards me, it had to be a wheel because there's nothing else makes that sound. There's lots of sounds when you're in the countryside in Donegal. You'll hear the sheep bleating, you'll hear the cows mooing, you'll even hear the odd horse. Not as many horses, though. But Donegal's a beautiful, one of the most beautiful counties to be in, and lots of nature of all kinds is there.
There you go. Tommy from Belfast and also a member of the Donegal Tourist Board.
Donegal a boo and Tommy a boo.
Yeah.
Ray D'Arcy Show reporter Sinead the Niulachan talking to people in North County Dublin this afternoon about their favourite sounds in nature. Soothing radio in a world gone mad. Adolescence, the acclaimed Stephen Graham drama, streaming on Netflix, examines the effects of incel culture and social media on teenage boys and has led to many parents of teens professing to be shocked at what goes on in their children's lives that they were totally unaware of. This morning, Oliver Callan spoke to novelist Catherine Persifka about adolescence and what it's like for kids growing up online.
Are you kind of surprised by people's reaction to adolescence and how shocked they are by
this
reality?
Yes, I think it's a shocking programme and very well put together. I think that's the intent, but none of this is new. You know, I remember growing up and the first kind of misogynistic violent attack was in 2014 with Elliot Rodger in California, where he published a manifesto. And I remember being 18 and reading this and knowing about it. And here we are 11 years and people are still shocked that it could happen.
It's getting worse.
It's getting worse. I think when I was growing up with these kind of communities, I was aware of them, but they were very much siloed. They were on forums that you could, you know, seek out and look at them. But now with the internet and with the algorithm, and nobody's looking up anything anymore, it's just being fed to them. And I think it's become mainstream somehow.
It's extraordinary. These online communities, which are literally worldwide, aren't they? And they involve kids literally all over the place. It's built up around a hatred of women.
Yes, I think something to be very clear about this is some of the language that I'm going to use and hopefully explain sounds kind of silly, you know, sounds like you just should dismiss it and nobody believes that, but they do. And I think there are certain things that need to be explained, such as the manosphere. That, again, it sounds like a ridiculous term, but
yes,
what does that mean?
It's
kind of a loose like network of communities that believe essentially that, you know, they are entitled to women, to women's bodies, that they should have them. And if they don't, they blame women for. And so there are incels, involuntary celibates, who would like a relationship with a woman, but feel that they would never get it for a variety of different reasons, mainly to do with how they look or maybe their intelligence level or what they can offer a woman. They also believe that society is kind of structured around romantic relationships and it's the ultimate like goal in life and the ultimate happiness that is being denied to them by women specifically. So they objectify them and they hate them. There are also the kind of voluntary celibates, which are volcels, or they're part of the men going their own way community, where they basically have woken up to the fact that this is the perceived truth. That's what the red pill is, perceiving this fundamental truth about society. And the
this
black
is a trope
pill,
taken from the Matrix, essentially.
Yes, it's taken from the Matrix. Sorry, definitely slow me down if I'm going too quickly, because okay. I know there's a lot going on here, but I think it's so important. But taking the black pill is essentially agreeing to that, saying, yes, this is the truth and there's nothing I will ever be able to do about it.
Women will never fancy me.
Never, ever.
It's their fault and I'm going to take my revenge. Basically.
Yes. Or, I mean, there's also the crisis of mental health in young boys where they have this term called like lie down and rot, L-D-A-R, that you might see on forums. And that basically just means you might as well just roll over and die because there's nothing that you can do. And you can see how that like would affect the mental health of a young boy.
Yeah, the word's against them and they're not going to be successful in any.
It's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. I think when you have language that kind of gives you a label for something that you start identifying with. So I think you see it in the show where, you know, this boy who's 13 years old says, well, I think I am an incel. Yes. And everyone's like, well, what do you mean? You're only 13. Like, you're not going to, you know, have had all of these experiences yet. But they're kind of pre-primed to believe something about themselves. And I think what happens in the show is you see a young boy who's been exposed to this ideology and then is rejected, doesn't know how to handle it, but immediately filters it through the worldview of this kind of red pill, black cell, incel ideology.
And again, the words sound a bit silly, but so too does the imagery, because it's a language of emojis, which are the little pictorial symbols that kids text each other. And I think most of the world do at this stage, and I've seen them at some point. Yeah. And that's what the police in the show are. I think this has shocked people the most, isn't it? That they're seeing purple hearts, yellow hearts, certain words they think are fairly harmless, but they have a coded meaning in this teenage language of Instagram.
Yeah, well, I mean, all language is coded, you know, and teenagers have a way of talking that their parents will never understand and kind of always have. And I think that's the important thing of it's kind of time to wake up and realize that Like, you could be the best parent in the world. You could be looking at your child's phone. You could be reading their messages and you don't actually understand them.
Right.
You don't know what to look out for. And I think that comes into the content moderation as well. So, you know, Instagram is suggesting they're going to have teen accounts and that's going to be really, really good. Mm. But what that mainly does is like a keyword filter, or, you know, there are certain things that will be filtered out of someone's feed. But I mean, how do you filter out a word that you don't know? And often
and it's
the words,
their own, they're regulating themselves again, which is the problem.
Yeah, yeah.
They aren't going to
and
get
often the
line.
Words are very benign. You know, they have a word for like an attractive woman who they'll never be able to get. And it's just like a Stacey. It's a name. There's a Chad, which is kind of an alpha male figure. And then there's kind of like a normie, which is like a normal average guy. And then there's the incel on the level below. And then you have your Stacey's for your women and you have your Becky's for you. These are just names.
These are teenage boys are using the terminology.
Yeah, yeah. So. This is, they're, like, you should look up a list of the incel terminology, because these are things that you cannot fundamentally filter out or recognize. And I think that is what we need to wake up to, that we can't rely upon platforms or even just an awareness that it's going to be like, oh, if I can just learn the emojis, I'll get it.
Yeah.
Because there are so many levels of meaning here that people aren't aware of.
The social media companies you mentioned, which are not regulated by governments all over the world, but especially in Ireland, because we can control it for all of Europe. Their algorithms take out words like, they'll be alerted to words like kill or porn. But the kids have figured a way around all of this.
Yeah, like, I mean, you'll see it on TikTok. And what it does is kind of nearly devalue the concept, you know. So instead of saying kill, because they might be filtered out or they might be algorithmically unfriendly, people will just say unalive. Instead of Nazi, they'll say Yahtzee. Instead of porn, they'll say corn, or they'll use the corn emoji. And
wow.
So everybody knows this.
That's a double code.
It comes up. Yeah. And it's like, it's just this language that has slowly developed to skirt the algorithm. And so that could be for benign purposes. It could even be for benevolent purposes, you know, to raise awareness of what's happening.
Right, I see.
But you can see how that can be weaponized, you know, or used to skirt the algorithm.
Impossible to filter out, because obviously that language is going to change all the time.
All the time. And the moment you say, actually, you're not going to get any views if you use this word, they're going to change the word.
Yeah. There's the kids love being on the internet. It's a fun place to be.
We all love being on the internet, you know. I used to believe, sure, look, there are benefits to being online and things like that. And I'm addicted to my phone. I'll put my hands up and say that I am always scrolling. But it's harder and harder to see any benefit when you look at what we're actually being exposing children to. And I think this is the generational divide, where I feel like the events of the show are not surprising. I know what these forums are like. I know what young boys are exposed to, what they're talking about, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
If you don't, then you're absolutely shocked. But if you don't understand this, why are you letting your child loose in this world?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I knew it. It's the parents' fault. That's the rather harsh, I would have thought, view of novelist Catherine Prasivka on teenage boys and the whole online incel culture that's having a moment under the spotlight thanks to the Netflix drama Adolescence. And that's all I have for you on this A Little Like Spring edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Shurathon. Don't forget, you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio app. And the mothership, that's Playback, is on air and in podcast land every Saturday, when Sinead Mooney has a finer, fitter, flashier look back at an entire week in radio. For me though, until tomorrow, thank you for listening and good luck.